This reading is an excerpt from Aunt Jane in Kentucky by Eliza Calvert Hall. I've had a heap of comfort all my life making quilts, and now in my old age I wouldn't take a fortune for 'em. You see, some folks has albums to put folks' pictures in to remember 'em by, and some folks has a book and writes down the things that happen every day so they won't forget 'em. But, honey, these quilts is my albums and my diaries, and whenever the weather's bad and I can't get out to see folks, I just spread out my quilts and look at 'em and study over 'em, and it's just like going back 50 or 60 years and living my life over again. Did you ever think, child, how much piecing a quilt's like living a life? And as for sermons, why, they ain't no better sermon to me than a patchwork quilt. And the doctrines is right there a heap plainer than they is in the catechism. Many a time I've sat and listened to Parson Page preaching about predestination and free will, and I've said to myself, well, I ain't never been through Center College up at Danville, but if I could just get up in the pulpit with one of my quilts, I could make it a heap plainer to folks than Parson's making it with all his big words. You see, you start out with just so much caliker. You don't go to the store and pick it out and buy it, but the neighbors will give you a piece here and a piece there, and you'll have a piece left every time you cut out a dress. And you take just what happens to come, and that's like predestination. And when it comes to the cutting out, why, you're free to choose your own pattern. You can give the same kind of pieces to two persons, and one'll make a nine patch, and one'll make a wild goose chase, and there'll be two quilts made out of the same kind of pieces, and just as different as can be. And that's just the way with living. The Lord sends us the pieces, but we can cut 'em out and put 'em together pretty much to suit ourselves. And there's a heap more in the cutting out and the sewing than there is in the caliker. I've been a hard worker all my life, but most all my work has been the kind that perishes with the using, as the Bible says. That's the discouraging thing about a woman's work. Millie Amos used to say that if a woman was to see all the dishes that she had to wash before she died piled up before her in one pile, she'd lie down and die right there and then. But when one of my grandchildren or great-grandchildren sees one of these quilts, they'll think about Aunt Jane, and wherever I am then, I'll know I ain't forgotten. I reckon everybody wants to leave something behind them that'll last after they're dead and gone. It don't look like it's worthwhile to live unless you can do that. Now, some folks has money to build monuments with, great tall marble pillars with angels on top of 'em, like you see in Cave Hill and them big city burying grounds. And some folks can build churches and schools and hospitals to keep folks in mind of them. But all the work I've got to leave behind me is just these quilts. And sometimes when I'm setting here, working with my caliker and gingham pieces, I'll finish off a block, and I laugh and say to myself, well, here's another stone for the monument. End of reading. Growing up, I imagined the best life, the most beautiful life, as a seamless, unbroken whole. Sometimes I saw myself in the convent, selflessly devoting myself, my life, to my community, to the students I would be teaching, and, of course, to God. Sometimes I saw myself as a wife and mother, creating an easy and happy home life for husband and children. Once in a great while, I imagined myself as a famous detective like Nancy Drew, or an actress enriching the world with my talent. But whatever path I imagined, it was always straight and easy. I did not imagine the curves and detours, the dead ends, the tears and cracks, the good and bad patches that make up real life. And I certainly never imagined that all of these could make life richer and even more beautiful than the straight line and seamless whole I was trying to stitch. In my young adult life, I first lost my faith in the straight line and seamless whole, but could not yet imagine a messier but richer pattern. It was the Christian faith, as I understood it then, the comforting worldview that an all-good and all-powerful God would somehow right all of the world's injustice that was torn in pieces for me. That was my first rending of the seamless whole. At the time, I was helped by a wonderful friend, a Catholic nun in whom I'd confided, a colleague where I was teaching, who gave me a poem by Sylvia Plath. As you know, Sylvia Plath struggled to find enough meaning or pattern or beauty in her own life, and eventually she committed suicide. But at the time of this poem in 1956, she was still able to take hope from a bird, a black rook in rainy weather. She first describes a dull landscape from which she expects little or nothing of consequence. And yet she knows that, as rarely as it might occur, something more is possible. I only know that a rook, ordering its black feathers, can so shine as to seize my senses, haul my eyelids up, and grant a brief respite from fear of total neutrality. With luck, trekking stubborn through this season of fatigue, I shall patch together a content of sorts. Miracles occur if you care to call these spasmodic tricks of radiance miracles. The wait's begun again, the long wait for the angel, for that rare, random descent. I shall patch together a content of sorts. Not the seamless whole of my childhood imagination, but a different kind of whole, and ultimately one more meaningful. Like Aunt Jane, Plath implies that there is much in human life beyond our control. You just take what happens to come, as Aunt Jane said. We cannot control all the circumstances of our lives. We cannot force those spasmodic tricks of radiance to occur. But we have some power to shape our response to those circumstances. We can cut them and put them together pretty much to suit ourselves, as Aunt Jane says. We have some power to create something of beauty from them, whether it's a patchwork quilt, a poem, or a life. In the United States, patchwork quilts originated out of the necessary repairs that women made to the bed quilts that they could not afford to replace when a piece got worn or torn. What began out of poverty was transformed into art, and later into communal art with the development of quilting bees. I cannot help but wonder if Amish women created their own spasmodic tricks of radiance when they used brightly colored patches in their quilts, colors that would not be found in their clothing. Although it may seem strange to us, the patchwork would sometimes include the shapes of coffins with the names of dead family members stitched onto them, a way of keeping the memory of loved ones alive and close. Here was a way to honor life and love and to create beauty, even in the face of death. Perhaps that does not seem strange at all when we think of the AIDS quilt in our own time, an expression of grief and reverence for those who have died, a way of turning grief into beauty, and a way for so many individuals suffering the loss of family members or partners or friends to keep company with others suffering similar losses. One person involved in the aid quilt reported that the first time I laughed after my son's death was the day I attended a quilt workshop and started to make his quilt. Given that quilts so often carried the memories of friends with whom the quilters had sewn and visited, or the names of people the quilters had loved, no wonder they began to be called comforters. Even in dull, ruinous landscapes, Sylvia Plath says, we can find and perhaps even create beauty. A patchwork quilt, a poem, a life. I do not know why some people are overwhelmed or even destroyed by suffering or difficulty, while others are able to patch together a content of beauty or goodness or both. But I am heartened by stories of the latter. Among them is a novel by Mary Webb, published in 1924, called Precious Bane. It was also made many years ago into a Masterpiece Theater production, which some of you may have seen. The central character is Prudence Sarn, a young woman living with her mother and her brother in the English countryside of the 19th century. The precious bane of the title is Prudence's cleft lip, which in the 19th century there was no surgery to heal. An affliction that not only made some people shun Prudence for her looks, but fear her as a witch. And yet seemingly, at least in part, because of her affliction, Prudence grows into a kind and compassionate woman. Her greatest suffering is her loneliness, and when she falls in love with a visiting and handsome weaver, her conviction that such a man, indeed no man at all, could ever love her. If you don't know the story, I hope you don't mind my telling you that the novel ends happily. The townspeople, desperate to blame someone for their hard life and various misfortunes, desperate for a scapegoat, finally attempt to drown Prudence based on charges of witchcraft. It is the weaver, Kester Woodseaves, who saves her and in true romantic fashion carries her off on her horse. Okay, let me admit it. I love it. As they ride away, Prudence protests that Kester cannot want to marry a woman who looks like her, but ought to marry a girl who looks like a lily. Instead, Kester responds, "No more sad talk. I've chosen my bit of paradise. 'Tis on your breast, my dear acquaintance." And then Prudence tells us the last line in the story. "And when he'd said these words, he bent his comely head and kissed me full upon the mouth." Prudence may not be conventionally beautiful. With her cleft lip, her face is literally not the seamless hole we are used to seeing. But she has created, out of the difficult circumstances of her life, a depth of kindness and richness of feeling that Kester finds much more beautiful than a conventionally pretty face. It cannot be accidental that Kester is a weaver in the story. He has trained his eyes and more importantly, his mind and his heart, to see the patterns that lie below the surface. He understands Aunt Jane's powerful lesson that there's a heap more in the cutting out and the sewing than there is in the calico. Physician and therapist Rachel Naomi Raymond tells a story that fits well into this theme. A young cancer patient with whom Raymond worked responded with deep anger when he had to have one of his legs amputated. During one of their therapy sessions, Raymond asked the young man to draw a picture of his body. He drew an outline of his face, and then with a black crayon drew over and over a line representing a crack through the vase's center. This was clearly a vase that could not hold water, could not be a vase again. This young man's anger over his loss eventually began to turn into concern for other young people suffering similar losses. And Raymond was able to connect him with some of these people. Because of his own misfortune, he was often able to reach these patients and help their families and doctors understand them in ways others could not. Over time, his anger receded, replaced by joy at the difference he was making in other patients' lives. One day he visited a 21-year-old woman who had just had both breasts removed because of breast cancer, to which disease she had already lost her mother, a sister, and a cousin, and from which a second sister was suffering. Nothing the young man could say or do could reach this woman. She refused even to look at him. It was a summer day, and he happened to be in shorts so that his artificial leg was obvious. In desperation, he unstrapped his leg and let it thump to the floor, and that made her look up. So he started to hop around the room in time to some music coming from the radio. And finally she laughed. "Fella," she said, "if you can dance, maybe I can sing." At their final session together, Raymond remembered the drawing of the vase with the deep and dark crack. The young man looked at it and said that it was unfinished. He took a yellow crayon and drew several yellow lines from the crack to the edge of the paper. Finally, Raymond writes, he put his finger on the crack, looked at me, and said softly, "This is where the light comes through." Out of something cracked and broken, this man was helped to create compassion and beauty and even love. He and the young woman he had visited eventually married, and together they worked with other young people also suffering loss. Oddly enough, this man's life became deeper, more deeply whole, richer in love and relationships because of the deep crack he had experienced. Once again, we hear Aunt Jane, "There's a heap more in the cutting out and the sewing than there is in the calico." Sometimes the cracks or tears or holes we experience come to us from circumstances beyond our control. But sometimes they are the result of our own mistaken or bad choices. We cannot erase them or fill them up as if we had never done them. But we can work to bring good or even beauty out of them as well. This, to me, is one of Shakespeare's most powerful lessons, found especially in his later plays, such as Measure for Measure and The Winter's Tale. In Measure for Measure is my favorite line in all of Shakespeare, and like Sylvia Plath's poem, these are words that have helped me. "They say best men are molded out of faults, and for the most, become much more the better for being a little bad. Some of the best people I have known are those who turn their own failings and limitations into compassion and understanding for others. And what an example they have been for me. A patchwork quilt is not only a powerful metaphor for an individual human life, but for communities like our Unitarian Universalist congregations. The very history of our association is a patching together of two originally separate denominations, Universalism and Unitarianism. And Unitarianism in the United States was originally torn from the fabric of Congregationalism. Over time, we have come to recognize the strength and beauty to be found in diverse religious and philosophical traditions. Here, we are not looking for straight lines and seamless holes. Here, we might say, messiness is welcome. We are here because we recognize that it is up to us to patch together a content of sorts, to patch together meaningful lives as best we can, out of all the curves and tears and holes and patches that life throws us or that we throw ourselves. And we know that together we can create something more beautiful than any of us can create alone, whether a patchwork quilt, a social justice project, an individual life, or a religious community. And each time we finish off a block, we too can laugh and say with Aunt Jane, "Well, here's another stone for the monument." So may it be.